Brought to you by Face to Face Games.
The first rule of Fight Club is...
So we're good. We got this. First ever. Three men in a garage. I don't know what's going on. making air quotes soap.
Three-way soap.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Welcome to another amazing episode of Hype Club. It is episode 10. We made it. We're in double digits. I am Matty Studios, as always.
I'm Tony Awesome Sauce, and today we have a fantastic guest.
Our first
Howdy.
Ever. So, we got Kelly Ackerman.
The man with the cowboy hat.
You know him from such hits as owner of Face to Face Toronto and best GP doer of GP.
GP doer.
What is
that
your
is
actual
the official
title?
Name.
Yeah. Doer of GPs, nice.
My official Ranger. Title is co-owner of Face to Face Games Toronto, and as it jokingly says on my business card, Director of Ontario Operations, which was a bogus title that Schmaltzy made up for me when we first started the company. He was like, I don't know, call yourself Director of Ontario Operations or something. And then I did, and I printed it on a business card, and he was like, wait, you actually printed that?
It's so funny, yeah, because when you start your own business, your title is pointless. It's just how much work you do in a day that needs to be done. So yeah. Even when I started my own business, I'd always hate to get the business cards because I'm like, it's pointless, man. Who cares what it says? So for the longest time, I wouldn't do it. And a couple of times in my life, my other partners have made me. They're like, no, we're getting business cards. You need one. So we're going to put, creative director on it or whatever you want. And I'm like, that really doesn't describe what I do. So for the longest time, my business card just said creative force.
That's it. I like that.
Yeah, it was funny because I'd introduce myself and they're like, so what is a creative force? I'm like, I just make things. And they're like, oh, that's cool. So in what part do you make things? I just make everything. Just that's all I do.
Anyways. My next business card will just say mountain mover, you know?
Yeah, oh, see? Problem solver. That's really what it is, right?
Fixer.
Maker of soap. My next one's going to just be soap maker. All right, well, let's get into the episode because a lot of stuff has happened. We've gotten the ban list announcement, which is nothing changed, which I know this time feels very bizarre because everyone had expected that we were going to see a lot of changes because the last time we had standard stuff banned, the environment mimics pretty much what we have right now. A couple of decks, there really isn't any innovation. There's powerful cards with very little answers that are just doing their thing, and there isn't much you can do with it. So we get no ban list this time.
I'm going to disagree with you there. I think standard is way healthier than it was this time, two and a half months ago.
Okay.
And although in some ways you're right that there hasn't been like much innovation, we have a pretty solid rock, paper, scissors format. We're seeing top eights that are either like four copies of one deck and four copies of a different deck. There's all this sort of tweaking has evolved and all these like...
There's minor changes.
Yeah, but
minor.
Those minor changes make a huge difference. And in standard, that's kind of...
But they don't. And you know why?
They totally do.
No, they don't. And you know why? Because they only matter to the two decks that are fighting. So there's two decks that keep fighting each other and the changes they're making are to improve their matchup versus that other deck or the mirror. There isn't a new deck coming in and saying, oh, check this out, guys, boom, and giving both decks pause for thought and be like, we got to deal with this now. So, for a while it was green-black counters. That is still there, but it's very clearly not tier one. It's tier two, and it's really four-color Shaheeli versus Mardu vehicles right now. And it's interesting that you're seeing cards like Gideon, like these cards that were supposed to be banned, or, in the let's go back a year, they weren't supposed to even be in standard right now. And because we had to go back to revert standard to the longer ability or a longer time, we're having these cards that I think R&D didn't realize would be there. And so I think we're in this weird time for the next couple sets where, you know, all the sets that are coming out weren't built to take into account that standard's longer. And we're just going to have to deal with this for a while.
All right. I'm going to fact check you here.
I love
because
it.
Under the old, the 18-month rotation system that we are no longer in, Gideon would still be legal until Amonkhet comes out. Gideon wouldn't, Battle for Zendikar and Oath would rotate out when Amonkhet got released. That was the original plan. Now they'll be in until Atlantis set or whatever comes out. But this is part of the plan. They definitely like,
okay.
Nothing is fresh. Nothing's been changed because they changed that at this point.
I mean, Aaron Forsyth. I hate that. He trips me up. He did tweet. He's like, look, we have more announcements. That doesn't mean more bans. Coming from like Tony, you're a brewer. Really, when the ban list change is about to happen, or like even it doesn't even happen, just announcement is happening today or leading up to it, you have to start to think as a brewer, okay, is my deck going to get banned? And if it does, what am I looking at?
Well, I mean, I think as a brewer, I'm actually less concerned about that. But I have faith in Wizards to do what's right for the health and wellness of the game and the players. I feel like recently they've been doing a very good job of proving that. With their, you know, the reasons for their bannings being this game isn't fun. People aren't having fun. That's the most important thing. So, if I want to play, in different formats that appease different sort of power levels and types and styles of gameplays, because Frontier exists, I feel like I have all those avenues now. So I'm not really like concerned if things get banned in Standard. I think it kind of looks bad on them by having cards that actually need to be intervened upon, but there's a home for every card, and I see that. So I'm not really surprised that nothing got banned. I'm kind of happy that nothing got banned, as I don't really think it's necessary. And we have a new set coming out in, you know, a few weeks, and we have Modern Masters that we can all wet our whistle with over the next little while to take a step back from Standard. So we have options now, and I think more than ever, we have very good options. If you're not having fun with Rock, Paper, Scissors and Standard, there are many, many other great things you can do to play Magic.
So what you bring up is very interesting, and I was referring mostly directly to Standard, which, again, is the corporate line from Wizards. They don't really want to talk about anything else. It's Standard, Standard, Standard. But from, I think Wizards, if they really considered the health of the overall game and not just the health of Standard, they would really talk more like you guys, where you say, look, Magic isn't one format. If Standard isn't your jam right now, and that could be for many reasons, maybe you just don't like the set, the environment, the characters, or you don't like the metagame. If you're playing Magic in general as your hobby, then you can play Frontier, you can play Modern, you can play other formats. And I feel if Wizards embraced that a little bit more, and it, you know, not to take all the shine off Standard, but if they did that, it wouldn't feel so impactful when they have a ban in Standard or they don't. Because you'd be like, all right, well, like you just said, I'm going to play Modern for a bit, or I'm going to check out how my Standard cards work in Frontier right now. And you're still playing Magic and having fun. You know, that's one thing I feel like, there needs to be a little bit less emphasis on Standard.
So here's why I think Wizards is front-loading all their brain power on Standard right now. And I think
this is what I want to hear.
They look at the game of Magic as a whole. And I think they actually do sit down at the table and they say, we want to progress this game forward. Let's look at everything. And they look at the Modern community. They look at Legacy. They look at Commander. They look at all these sort of fringe formats. You know, beyond those three being the big ones, and then like 93, 94, and whatever else, Frontier, and everything else sort of as like more stuff. And they're like, these formats are taking care of themselves. Like, there are people in the world who care a lot about this and put a lot of effort into this, and we don't need to. And nobody gives a hoot about Standard, so we really actually need to be the ones picking up the banner on Standard, because nobody else is going to if we don't. And so they're saying, we'll put our effort into Standard, because the other formats are doing just fine. People love them, people play them, and we don't need to force feed them. We'll do a little smattering of Modern Masters here and a Commander product in the fall there and stuff like that. But
that's a good way to look at it. That makes sense. I mean, they're the flag carriers for the flag bearing format of Magic.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. I think it's just as players move out into those formats, all they really want is, I don't think they really even want Wizards to scream it. They just want to feel like, I guess they just want to see, like, can I see my format shine a little? That's all, you know? And, like, that's why when we saw the Modern GP get axed, it was just like, really, it was Modern players felt hurt because they're just like, I really liked watching my format. You know, it was less about Wizards meddling with the ban list and more just like, I really liked watching it. You know, so it's just Wizards, I understand they have to sell Standard, and I think they can still do that, but just a little more here or there, you know, to show other formats. That's all.
But again, I'm maybe this is a good segue, but Modern Masters 2017 is going to sell itself. They literally told us nothing about the set until 2 weeks ago, and they're like, oh, by the way, here it's loaded, it's really cool. Yeah, okay, but also Amonkhet's coming out, and they didn't focus on Modern Masters for any more than a second, but we all did. We all said, oh, okay, yeah, you keep talking about Amonkhet, but we're going to go into, like, spirals on Reddit threads about Modern Masters and the value, blah, 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 blah. Right? I mean, they could have literally said nothing about the product and just released it onto the shelves, and it still would have been insane.
But that's because it is insane. Like, you have to realize, they don't need to advertise this set, because it is, hands down, in my opinion, the best reprint set ever made and probably will ever be made. I think this is the Jace the Mind Sculptor. This is the one where they're like, yikes. They put everything and the kitchen sink into this. I never believe we'll see anything close to this level of value in a set again. And that's maybe because of what this will do to the secondary market, and cards won't recover fast enough for the next time. So even if they did put these same cards in it, they're still not that valuable. I'm not sure, but this feels like, you're correct, this set didn't need any promotion. It's absurd. And then, like, I don't know on the ground how the hype is, but in the internet, it's insane.
Yeah, on the ground, in the air, in the sea, it's insane. It's like, it's bananas. But
so what do you, yes.
If we're going to talk about it, there's all these people being like, this set's unlimited, there's going to be as much of it as we want, blah, blah, blah. I definitely made promotional sales buying into some of that hype, even though I had factual data sort of telling me otherwise. But I was like, well, maybe my data is wrong. Like, maybe my distributors have more than they say they have, and they're going to call me on, like, Tuesday before the set and, like, give me a bunch more. I don't know. But this product is not unlimited. I am definitely being told by my distributors that this is all I can get of Modern Masters.
That is very interesting, because a lot of people, other store owners and things online, have been boasting that when they ask for their regular, let's say, 100 boxes, they're like, distributors like, sure. And then, like, can I have another 100? They're like, sure. So that's not, I mean, to a normal person, that's like, that feels unlimited, but it's not. Again, you're probably from a store where you can move much more than a small mom and pop shop that can order a case and they've been told they can have two cases.
Yeah.
So now you're like, you know, it is, we all know it's not unlimited. I think, though, that from what I heard, no one's going to confirm this because I guess no one has that data, but they're saying that the waves are going to be on par with, like, twice the size of Modern Masters 2015, or some people even say four times the size. Is there any legitimacy to that?
In terms of the numbers, literally anyone giving you numbers or, like, saying it's twice as big is just making things up, because, like, we didn't know how big 2015 was. we don't know how big this is. So there's no way of being able to compare them other than booster pack availability. Like, and there's so many factors. Like, Wizards is so secretive about how big the print runs are. And then there's so many factors within the print runs. Like, I could call up my distributor tomorrow and still get some Modern Masters 2015. You know, I had another store owner call me being like, hey, you want to buy some Modern Masters 2015 from me? I'm like, yeah, I'll buy it like 20% below what I paid for it, but I don't need it, right? Like, but think about the set. That set was, people weren't excited about opening it because it just didn't have the value. So how much of got printed got opened, you know, we don't know. So
that's true. I think everyone is more scared of what happened with Eternal Masters. And people don't understand, like, is this a front heavy wave? Like, all the product is first wave. It's huge. It feels unlimited, but it isn't. Or is it like, here's half the product, and then in January or December, Christmas time surprise.
Sure.
And I think
sure.
this is where I understand maybe Wizards does this for hype reasons, but it feels like we just want data, like clarity. Like, just tell us what the deal is so we know.
So the only people that get hurt by, or in my mind, the only people who got hurt by the fall or the late fall release of, or second release of Eternal Masters is the people sitting on sealed product. Like, there's people who have invested in Modern Masters or Eternal Masters in the past or any sealed product because they're like, oh, this is going to go up in value because it always goes up right. in value because it's Magic sealed product. And that's true. As a general rule, that's true. So there's I have, like, again, this is me totally making up numbers, but I have cooked up up some crazy math that I actually feel is, like, somewhat accurate, and that is that an in-print standard legal set, if you spend $100 on that product, you will open about $80 worth of stuff that you pay sort of a 20% tax. You offer up 20% to the luck gods. In exchange for, like, the thrill of opening. Yeah, exactly. The lottery ticket effect. Like, and that's just sort of like 80% is about the number I cooked up. Now there's like algorithms and stuff on the web that'll, like, either confirm or deny that, accurate, but that's pretty close to reality. But then once a set goes out of print, there's this slip where it slips down to about 50%. And the lottery ticket effect just gets way more exaggerated because, well, yeah, I could open a Scars of Mirrodin pack and maybe I'll open that foil Mox Opal. Like, maybe it's in that pack sitting on that little store shelf in, you know, the middle of nowhere. But that pack is $15 now because, you know, because maybe, So,
so I guess then
the question is, does this stay in print and follow on the 80% rule, or does this slip to an out of print state? And that's what we saw with Eternal Masters. We saw Eternal Masters, the box price skyrocket so that it was about right on that 50% mark. Boxes were like 400, 450, and then boom, they announced the reprint, and boom, they slipped back down to 285 or 300 or whatever. And this is Canadian dollars. But the singles market didn't really change. The price of the singles within those booster packs stayed the same. The only thing that changed was people's perception of what the sealed product was worth. And that's that when we thought it was more limited, it was following that 50% rule. So the box and the pack price had to go up to compensate for that. And then once we knew there was more, it slipped down and got closer to that 80% rule. Like, yeah, the packs are cheaper because this isn't as limited as we thought it was. But the cards are still worth the same thing. Like,
no, you're right. The one question I keep hearing a lot of, and this is, like, recently, especially with that second wave of Eternal Masters, a lot of people have, like, wanted me to ask this question when we had someone who owns a store on. And that is, do you feel that Wizards is sending a clear message to the secondary? Maybe secondary market's the wrong word. Maybe it's hoarders or speculators. And they're trying to send a message to them and say, stop hoarding product, because it's very hard for Wizards to help lower the price of formats when hoarders and speculators exist, because they suck up the demand before it can get cheap enough for the average player to afford. Do you feel that that's just, is that real, fake? Is that just the feeling?
I feel like,
what do you think?
That feeling you're talking about is justified, but let's look at this from Wizards' perspective. If Wizards knows that they can print twice as much of something as they statistically should, because 50% of the overall supply is just going to disappear into people's closets, and they're just going to get paid to print twice as much as they need to or can, because people are just going to hoover it up and sit on it. Why would Wizards stop doing that? Like, hey, sweet.
Because Chronicles, they continue. So the reason why, and this is the argument I hear, and the counter to it is Chronicles. For 10, 20 years now, it seems, when we've been asking for reprints, their answer, Wizards' actual answer, is we take reprints seriously. We don't want another Chronicles. So,
yeah, and they say that. They say that to maintain our faith in their ability to not print stuff like crazy.
They're balancing the sword there, where they're like, they want to give us as much as they can sell, but at the same time, they just don't want to give us too much, where we say this is too much.
Yeah,
it's that ever fine line of profit versus okay. So
the most recent Chronicles has gone completely under the radar. Nobody has noticed that Return to Ravnica is the Chronicles of the modern age. They printed the hell.
Wow, I have never heard that.
There is so much Return to Ravnica. About 8 months ago, I was able to get boxes of Return to Ravnica at like discount blowout prices from one of my distributors because there is just so much of it. But it's got Shocklands in it. It's got Deathrise. It's got Abrupt Decay. It's got all these great cards. And if you ask any like Magic player who doesn't understand the distribution side, hey, if you were to have bought boxes in recent history to sit on, what would you buy? Oh, Return to Ravnica. It's got shocks in it. It's going to be valuable forever. Mm. And it's true. It will, because the sealed product, there's so much sealed product out there in people's basements that it just doesn't matter. There's only so much of it in circulation.
I mean, it's very funny that I've heard a lot of people talk about Return to Ravnica was the point when sets started to be printed at the higher volume.
Yep.
But I haven't heard that it was just Return to Ravnica. Like, are you saying that it's just that block that is like five times the next set? Or is it just, I believe that's when they started to say, okay, we can print way more. Because the game doubled. In 3 years, the game doubled and doubled again.
Absolutely. And so, Innistrad was a huge print run as well. But Innistrad wasn't anywhere near the size of Return to Ravnica. Because what's a box of Innistrad is like $400 now, $400 or $500. It's crazy. Oh, we sell it for $18 a pack, and it flies off the shelf. Like, yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, of every set, though, that's one of the best draft ones.
Oh, yeah. I still love that set. Oh, man. I would draft Innistrad in a heartbeat. You let me know when, and we'll do it.
Spider spawning. Let's go.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's Curse of the Bloody Tome, Ding Dong, mail you out. That's my jam. But I would say, and again, this is totally me just making up numbers, I would say there's twice as much Return to Ravnica in the world as there is Gatecrash. Like the next set, because
there you go.
Return to Ravnica kept disappearing off the shelves. It kept flying.
And there's still way more Dragon's Maze because no one liked that set at all.
I would say that in terms of the total print run, though, I would say Dragon's Maze is probably a quarter of what Return to Ravnica is, if not less, because there.
Yeah, but there's so much more sealed product everywhere. I see it just sitting everywhere.
Yeah, that's what you see, though, right? You don't see the boxes in people's closets. And
you're right.
Because when Wizards, what we're told, who knows, but what we're told is that sets are print on demand for about a year, 18 months after they've been released. And so, if Return to Ravnica just kept selling at $100 a box, because people were like, yeah, I'm going to buy it and sit on it forever, and then I'm going to be rich, and it's going to be great. And so if for every box of Gatecrash we sold five boxes of Return to Ravnica, even though we are drafting Gatecrash and sealed with Gatecrash or whatever, there was just more Return to Ravnica disappearing into people's closets.
I would have thought Cons would have outsold Return to Ravnica because fetch lands are way more important than Shockland. Like, for me, that's what I would have assumed that would have happened. And Cons was one of those sets, again, I think Cons was one of the best modern, I'm going to say modern era, post-Innistrad sets that Wizards has done to date.
I completely
just
agree.
Incredible set.
I completely agree. And I will say that the print run of Cons may well be as large as the print run of Return to Ravnica, but there are way fewer boxes of Cons sitting in people's closets than boxes of Return to Ravnica. And I'll tell you why. when Return to Ravnica came out was exactly, it was like, what, 3 years after Zendikar came out, which was the last set that people wished, that was the first set people wished they'd bought three cases of and put in their closet. So right when Return to Ravnica came out is when Zendikar spiked to about $400, $500, $600 a box. Not 600, probably $300 or $400 at that point in time. And so people were looking at that being like, yeah, sealed product's a legit investment. Rise of Eldrazi was about $300-$400 a box. Like, so people are looking back. World Wake is like, you know, $30-$50 a pack at that point. Like, it's crazy, right? So people are looking back at history, recent history, and saying, this is a safe investment. This is a reasonable investment. And a lot of people, that was when hashtag MTG Finance and stuff really kicked off. And a lot of people bought tons of that stuff and just put it away. Now, that being said, I think it's a totally reasonable thing to have done. Are you going to quadruple your money like you would have with boxes of Zendikar? No. But is a pack of Return to Ravnica safely going to be worth $5, $6, $7, $8 forever? Yes. And in the normal world of not MTG Finance, buying something, waiting 5 years, and having a 20% gain on it is perfectly acceptable. That's the hilarious thing.
I get it.
Magic players are like, what? My investment didn't triple in 8 months? What is, oh, this is shit. I mean, garbage.
You know,
it's, garbage.
It's funny because...
Anyway.
Yeah, it's all right. I had an episode where I that's what I did. We try to only have one mistake, one slip up. So that's it. No more. Here's the funny thing, though, that I've also noticed, and I don't try to advocate the whole, like, use Magic as an investment. It's just play and have fun and try to buy the hobby as affordably as you can. And if your cards do go up, that's great. But the point is to, if you got in at the lowest point, you're going to be able to play the hobby cheaper. And that's
absolutely
the game. The name of the game is to play as many formats as you can, at least for me and Tony, is play as many formats as you can, as cheaply as you can, and get the maximum enjoyment, right? Your time is valuable. So if you have the cards that you bought because you like them and they were affordable at that time, and now a new format, Frontier, whatever, or Janky Leaders or Giant Leaders or whatever it is, because that format's awesome, and you can just dig in your closet and put it together and you're playing, and it costs you nothing, theoretically. It's just your time. So that's something I always look at, and I know a bunch of my friends who, played the game when Modern came out because, that was like the big call. And now they're looking at Modern Masters or 2015 or 2017, and they're asking me, like, do I come back in? This looks crazy. So
absolutely.
I'm like, I don't know. Like, yes, like, if you want to play this, this looks fun. Like, this set actually looks like a cube draft. Like, of any Modern set I've ever seen, this looks like a cube draft. Like,
totally.
It is my cube. Like, I was pulling fictional packs out of my cube, and I'm like, oh, that's actually in the cube. So I don't know. This is going to be a set that looks fun to draft for the first time in a long time.
Okay.
There's no giant tribal garbage.
So the last thing I'll say on, like, hoarding sealed product, that was how I started investing in Magic, was hoarding sealed product. Well, six, eight years ago or whatever, I started buying boxes and putting them in my closet. And the reason is because, as someone who loves Limited, My whole thing was like, how am I going to cash this out? I bought it. I'm investing it. When am I going to redeem it? And the answer was just, I'm going to call up seven people I want to hang out with, get them to each bring me $30 to double my revenue, and we're going to draft. It's going to be the most fun, like, redeeming a GIC ever, because it's going to be like, hang out, have a fun night, play some Magic cards. Like, it's going to be perfect.
Yeah.
So that's why I say it is still a great idea. Because let's say in some crazy world, your sealed products were less than what you paid for it. It's literally never happened in the history of Magic if you're willing to wait long enough. But let's say it does. What's the worst thing that's going to happen? You're going to draft. You're just going to hang out with some friends and have a draft. Which doesn't sound like that bad a night to me. It sounds pretty good.
No. Like, we've made the analogy many times. Like, if you're going to take four people out to the movies, that's $200. Like, if you get a movie ticket and a popcorn and a drink, you're and that gives you 2 hours of fun.
Yeah.
So you can draft and you get 4 hours of fun.
Yep.
For less.
Yep.
And you can drink if you want.
Yeah.
Like, so it's,
totally.
It's your house. You do whatever you want. House rules.
Yeah. Or
right?
Or you go out to your local store and you do it there, like, We love it when people come in with a draft set of their own. Like, yo, can seven of my buddies and I hang out in the corner and draft? Like, yeah, do whatever you want. We got land here. Help yourself, you know?
As long as that's great. Look, I got to interrupt you because what you just said, I've never heard another game store ever. You just said that's like a restaurant saying, hey, you brought your own wine, no corking fee. So I'm just like, to a lot of people who don't realize, like, why does Maddie play it? Why does he drive 2 hours to go play a Fizz? That's why.
Yeah.
Shit like that.
Anyone who compares that to wine with no corking fee, though, is not paying attention, because the corking fee is the eight packs of sleeves you're going to sell because you now have eight drafters in your store. Like, somebody is going
to
spend money.
But I wanted the sleeves. The point is, it's really nice that you don't try to milk the things that, like, are put a bad taste in people's mouth. It's like, what? I just came here. So you have a friendly environment, which encourages, you know, more ability to just stay in a positive mind frame, which most people spend money when they're in a positive mind frame.
But All right. I'm going to do a quick history story. Back in the day, because it's great on this point. When I was a young man, in my teenage years, I used to organize sealed deck tournaments for my friends. After all my friends had quit Magic, I would, every 6 or 8 months, would get everybody together, and we would play sealed. And it was like sort of like the Magic reunion party. So one time, I was used to going to some store, buying a bunch of product, bringing it back to my place, having land. I would factor like pizza and Coke into the price and everything, like Coca-Cola. And that was like part of the whole thing. But one year, I found the store with the cheapest price in town was willing. They were like, why don't you just do your sealed deck tournament here? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, they were like, yeah, I've got table space, you guys are buying my product, you can play your tournament here. I was like, and like you just were saying, it blew my mind that he was willing to let us hang out in his store, and you know, and we were even spending money there, and it still shocked me. So I understand, because it took me a while to learn it too, but I learned that when I was 15. Like, oh yeah, store owners want you in their store because that's good for business.
Well, good store owners understand.
Sure.
From where I'm from in Oakville, there's a lot of stores because we have Sheridan College. There's a lot of like Magic stores. It's just, in my opinion, most of the Magic stores don't run that way. They run on maximum value, period. So it's maximum amount of money they can make and screw you. So while it's a nice clean store and it's nicely done, there's very clearly an atmosphere of profit over people.
Sure.
So, and it turns me off. It's just why, I just can't go to stores like that, because it's just, and I'm not looking to like take advantage of the store owner, but it's just, there are certain points when it's like, really?
But people,
like, I ask,
I'm going to defend random store owner that is a mythical creature at this point, because at some point, like, I look at customers who walk through my door that I like take care of and create a space for. I look at them as profit centers too, right? I'm just looking at it through a different lens. Like in Oakville, there's a store that shares its space with a martial arts dojo or a gym or something. And apparently the owner was like, yeah, I make way more money off running a gym than I do off running a game store. So it only makes financial sense for me to make the gym bigger and the game store smaller. I don't know the whole story, but let's say that's the story. I get it. Then run a gym.
That I heard too. Yeah.
Run a gym.
And that's fine. Yeah.
And I only create a safe, fun, awesome play space for people because it's profitable. If we weren't making money doing what we do, I would have to find a different way to do it. Right.
So, no. I mean, I guess I totally understand that. And that really wasn't, it's more like you're clearly making money, and then there's a point at which you're like, there's no reward or there's no attempt at trying to create a relationship with a customer. It's just the money.
Sure.
So that's where it feels like, you know, you can feel it as a customer and like someone who like offers a service. That's my job too. Like I make creative stuff for people. That's what I do. So I understand there's a point at which sometimes a client is asking for something and you have to take a bit of a value hit on it to keep the relationship somewhat in balance is kind of the way I look at it. And other times, you know, you save the client's butt and you bill them whatever you need to bill them and they're happy to do it. But, you know, it's just something to be attuned to. You know, what value has been exchanged? It's something to always watch. And I know, and I noticed that good people, good store owners especially, understand that fostering that environment and understanding of always watching what I call the scales, right? They're always watching like the scales. And I'm sure the customer that always comes in and says, can I have a 20% deal? Yeah, that guy is obviously not watching the scales, right? The balance is not there. So slowly that relationship gets a little colder. Versus the other time when the client's just like, here's $20, and you're like, well, it was only $18.95, and the client's already running out the door. So it's just, you know, it's one of those things, right? Like, create a good environment, which you guys do, and then make sure you're just being aware that people are people. They're not profits too. And you do a great job of that. That's why I'm just trying to like,
yeah.
I'm trying to give you the slow clap, you know, like it's something I continually notice. And especially too, that you guys are entering your second or third year now?
We're halfway through the third year. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
2.5 years old now. Oh, man, it's crazy.
Oh, my God. I'm getting old.
Me too.
That's crazy. But you're still doing it, which is, like, awesome that, you know, you're always looking to one-up stuff. So let's move
on.
Yeah,
we're getting down the rabbit hole
here, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's okay. Sometimes we do. The real reason we brought you on, because you released an article, which kind of blew up. We had a big announcement, as you know, last week. We touched on it really quickly about, you know, Channel Fireball is taking over events in 2018, which there's a lot of pros to it and a lot of cons. And we really wanted to bring Kelly on because he had a really unique viewpoint, and that is of someone who's not only a store owner, but someone who puts on GP size, like size events. And in my opinion, and you know, you can clarify, but I think you are the premier GP organizer of Canada. And I might be like biased on this, but everything I've seen you do, and from what I've heard people talk about you, that's what you are. So like, what's your overall or initial reaction? Like, give us your thoughts on this whole future of GPs, as it were.
Totally. So the article I wrote is actually titled "Sal and Kelly Get Fired," which was
funny.
I was gonna call it "I Got Fired." And I was talking to Sal, and he was like, "What about me? I got fired too." I was like, "Good point. We both got fired." It's like, good call. So,
okay,
but the whole point of the article was that although I just got fired from running future GPs after this one, you know, we've got to look on the bright side, and we've got to stay focused on what this means for the game. Because ultimately, running GPs was a ton of fun. I loved it. It's like, event management is like my jam. That's what I really am passionate about. But it's not the be all end all, right? At the end of the day, what's best for the game is going to be what's best for my business long term anyway. If that means I don't run one GP a year, or maybe they would, maybe in an alternate universe, they put us up to two GPs a year. Ooh. That's not, you know, I'm not living off that money, you know.
That's two weeks out of your year.
Yeah, well, it was like 6 months of planning out of my year, though.
Well, yeah. Sorry. It was crazy.
Yeah. So the and I guess, you know, a couple of the points about it is that's the biggest thing. As soon as I saw this, as soon as I saw the announcement, because I heard it about it a couple days before everybody else, because the PTOs, the Premier tournament organizers, there's like a special listserv that I had to sign an NDA to be a part of and all that. But we got an email about this, I think, on the Monday, and the announcement dropped on the Thursday of like, yep, here's the deal. CFB's doing it going forward. So long. Thanks for all the fish. It was the first thing I saw, I was like, oh my goodness. Can you imagine how efficient this system could be now? Like,
oh yeah,
the cogs started turning. I was like, oh my God, we could do this and that, and I could build all this infrastructure, and I could buy all these things that then would be like part of the kit, and all these like systems that get developed. You could like just mass market them. You could spend the time to like make them perfect instead of each organizer kind of like, well, I guess we'll run our side drafts like this, and that seems like a decent way to do it. Like, no, someone's gonna be able to. You could pay someone to be like, think for the next 2 weeks about how to make side drafts as efficient as possible at Grand Prix. Some of you are like, okay, cool. You know, I can't afford to do that. Now, that being said, we came up with a pretty sweet system for this year that I'm pretty excited about. But I'm going to sell it to CFB. But
you know, the one thing that, like, I agree with, there's a lot of efficiencies that when one person is controlled. I think that's a lot of people realize that initially. They're like, look, there's a lot of awesome ways. Like, you can take everything digital. You could have a single database and have everything digital. So you want to sign up for a draft, give us your phone. Here's a QR code. Your phone will beep when your draft's ready to go. Like, you can track. I mean, I don't know if they'll do any of this, but, like, in my head, you could track someone so you could sign them up for a season. So you go to any GP and your points carry over. That's very easily doable now. So there's a lot of things that could finally what I think take Magic to where it's 2017. Like, we've been in the Stone Age. We're sometimes with Magic, especially in a lot of areas of it, it runs like it's the 1980s.
Totally.
You know,
totally.
Where there's paper and you're like, what is going on? Like, I have a computer in my pocket that's more powerful than the one that went to the moon. Like, what's going on? Why can't we do this? You know? So hopefully there's going to be a lot of that.
Absolutely. And I think CFB is smart enough that they will absolutely be implementing a ton of that stuff. And I have full faith in them. Like, we could have like a little geek out session after where we like dream up all kinds of great ideas they could do. Cause I haven't been able to stop thinking about it.
Millions.
I know, right? And then we'll cut that part of the cast out and sell it to CFB.
Sell it to CFB. Gotcha. So what do you think are the negatives? Because I know I don't want to be negative on it. And, you know, social media really,
we
I got to
talk about
people
that
were excited. Because,
we got it.
Because there's. Yeah, and I just want to frame it in the fact that social media, people weren't being negative when they said, this is interesting, is this a monopoly? They weren't being negative. They weren't trying to attack. So
some people
all were. The people that were like, Jeff Hooger, there's a few people that just are negative in general. But my point is the general consensus that I saw wasn't negative. There's just people saying, this is something that we're conditioned to be wary of. Monopolies don't necessarily mean all benefits.
Totally.
So it's and look, Channel Fireball is not stupid. They're not going to shoot themselves in the head and be like, oh, we just got the contract, we're raising the prices and screwing everyone over for value.
Right.
They're not. They're probably gonna run at a loss the first year to make sure that, you know, everyone is excited and they get the next year's contract. And then that's where they normally, the way it works is then corporations look at their second and third year they're doing it and say, now we need to shave value out because we took a loss in the first 2 years to grow and the consumer confidence. Now we're looking for the value play.
Totally.
So that's normally how it happens. That's just business. But, you know, we have to be aware that there's a lot of TOs that now don't have jobs, which is one thing. There's the fact that judges don't really get paid in cardboard anymore. And I think a lot of people don't realize that they expect Channel Fireball to take over and now GPs will be $50 because, well, why not? And I wanted you to talk about, like, well, the reality of what a GP is, and also, like, there is potential negatives to being a monopoly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I think one of the great things about talking about the negatives is then we can share the flip
Make
side.
Make sure
of
they
that.
Don't happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if this is a potential negative, let's focus on it, pay attention to it, so that we can do everything we can to avoid it. And there's exactly. There's a bunch of like bullet points that I think every Magic player who attends Grand Prix or is thinking about attending Grand Prix should keep in the back of their mind as we move through the rest of this year, because mm-hmm. there's negatives associated with this for the rest of this year, even though CFB isn't running them.
Yep.
And then keep in mind going into 2018 as well. So the first is this monopoly idea. And the idea that this is a monopoly is potentially very scary, but it's not truly a monopoly, because in a monopoly, you don't have any checks and balances. And at the end of the day, what we have is a system where Wizards is still paying to make this happen. Wizards is...
Well, it's a contract.
It's a contract.
So this is
exactly.
Like, I wouldn't... When we use the term monopoly, we're using it the wrong way.
Exactly.
What it is you're giving an exclusive contract for a year. So during that year, yes, it technically is a monopoly because there isn't anyone else doing it. There's no one else offering a GP because it's a single service.
They elaborated that it was a multi-year contract for the foreseeable future was what they said.
Okay.
But that being said...
I did not hear that.
Yeah, that was an update. That was like in the first response after the announcement of like, oh, everyone's got all these questions. Here are some of the most popular ones. It was, yes, this is a multi-year contract. CFB is going to be investing substantially into making this good, so we're going to give them a couple years to make it profitable, like you said, right? So So it's the foreseeable future. But Wizards is still the one holding the purse strings at the end of the day. And if player feedback isn't getting better, if player feedback gets worse about GPs, I assume Wizards will sort of have a look at it and will be willing to revisit it.
Yeah, they can put the pressure on. Yeah, I mean, they can also just say, hey, guys, you know, feedback is X. Can you do anything about it?
Like, exactly.
So you're right. It's not a monopoly where
who knows?
It's them making the decision.
Who knows? It could be that part of the contract is that Wizards has said, we're not going to see the contract.
Stay out of it.
But it could be Wizards has said, you know what? If player feedback isn't up to par, you guys aren't getting your second quarter bonus or whatever, you know? Like, or if player feedback is negative. Like,
I would hope that it was structured that way with checks and balances and it's not just open.
Exactly.
You know, I would hope that. And I would hope that.
There's definitely, you know, in the previous system where there was a bunch of TOs, there was exactly that. If you didn't perform and you got bad feedback, either you weren't getting as many GPs the next year or you were still getting GPs, but you were under the microscope and there was serious conversations that happened of like, hey, clean up your act, take care of your customers, because we're tired of hearing about this, you know?
I mean, the consistency alone for a GP player, hopefully, like, in my mind, the consistency level is going to be pretty good. Like, that's the biggest benefit is GPs are just GPs now. And whatever the standard that CFB sets, that's just it. So that's really cool. It's like, you know, walking into a Tim Hortons here and walking into one in Vancouver, it's the corporate model. It's going to be the same. There's the same stuff. So,
and
while that is good for the people who had crappy GPs, my thing, and Tony brought this up last time, was it takes a little bit of the spice out of certain going to certain GPs because it's like, oh, this one used to be special because the tournament organizer would go crazy.
But
and now it's just
yeah.
Well,
but how do we know? How do we know that CFB isn't going to hire local organizers? Right? I mean, CFB is going to have weeks where they're going to have to run two different Grand Prix in the same weekend, right? So I mean, and again, this is just pure speculation, but I fully expect that if you attended a Hadayuya GP in Japan last year and you attend one in 2018, I bet you're going to see a lot of the same faces because I have a feeling CFB is going to call up Hadayuya and say, can you help us run this GP? You know your customers. You know what they like. You know how to run events. You know how to deal with your convention centers, blah, blah, blah. And instead of Wizards calling Hadayuya and saying, can you run a GP for us? It's going to be CFB calling them saying, can you run a GP for us? Oh, also, by the way, here's a bunch of infrastructure that we use, and this is how GPs are, and everyone goes to our website to sign up for it now, and we'll just cut you a check at the end of the week for running the event for us. Like,
that's great. That's what I hope we see. Right?
And in that sense, it has the potential to be way better because all of a sudden the TO on the ground isn't going to be the one controlling the purse strings and has the potential to provide much better customer service, right? You know, like, I don't know.
Right,
it could go that way. That is what I would like to see.
Talk to me. Yeah. Well, talk to me about one thing that I know a lot of people keep bringing up, and that is, what is the actual true cost of a GP and why won't they get cheaper? Because I know not many people get the chance to talk to someone who actually runs a GP and sees all the inside finances of how it runs. But people, as we've seen, you know, GPs are $100 now?
$100 US.
Sealed,
yep.
That hurts. Honestly, that there's a psychological breakpoint that if a GP is getting close to the price of a box, to me, that's when it starts to be mentally hard for me to process the value there.
Right.
But I understand that, you know, rents keep going up. Judges' salaries have to be paid. I understand all these things. So talk to me about the real cost. Like, are GPs just going to always be a slow rising, like, following
so there was,
economics? Like, that's just the way
there
it
is? There was a couple things that changed. Daniel Fournier posted an article from about 2 years ago, or it was like a thread on some message board where it was like, Pastimes was the first Grand Prix in GP Chicago 2014 or 2015, or I guess it was, yeah, it must have been 2015, announced that they were, the main event entry was $50 US. All the other ones have been 30 or 40 beforehand. And now, boom, $50 to get into the main event for a constructed standard Grand Prix. And the internet lost their mind. They were like, this is the worst. Mm-hmm. These guys are Satan. It's the end of the world, blah, blah, blah. And it's crazy because 2 years later, we're in a world where $100 US for a Grand Prix is like, yeah, that's just what these things cost now. It sucks. Whatever. And
I have to feel that the modern Masters Las Vegas GP has been the biggest culprit to raising prices because they were premier and because they changed the landscape and broke all the records. And I think it put a light on what people are willing to do for a GP, and that filtered down to the regular GPs. And people thought, oh, well, if people are willing to do that for Vegas, they must be willing to pay a little bit more.
And
I think it probably impacted the bottom line of a lot of regular GPs.
Totally. And there's a couple things that happened. So the biggest one, the biggest difference was that Wizards stopped supplying judge foils for the judges running the events. It used to be you as a TO got a big box of foils, and most of a judge's judge comp for the weekend was foils from Wizards, and the TO didn't pay a penny for that. The TO just got a bunch of foils. They got to pay their judges in foils. They had to give them some money for lunch. They had to put them up in a hotel, sure, probably, but all that's like expensible stuff that you can do. And you know, and then, oh, maybe you give them a couple boxes at the end of the week. But Wizards gave you a few boxes as sort of operational support anyway. So most of that was probably covered by WotC. I wasn't actually organizing GPs then, so I don't know the financials of it specifically.
Okay.
But I was judging a lot then, and I was used to like, yeah, got my foils. I got like $600 in foils for working this week. Sweet, because the new, you know, Imperial recruit
whatever
just came out. Yeah, or whatever. Yeah. And I got two of them. And as soon as you add staff costs to your ledger as a GP organizer, I'll tell you right now that staffing was as much or more than the venue last year, because
you
need an army of people.
75, 100, you have a lot. Yeah.
And that's just what you need. You just need that many people to run drafts and the main event and blah, blah, and ensure the integrity of the tournament. You can't really cut down on the number of judges required. It just, the more, you know, the standard rule in the judge world is about 25 to 30 players equals one judge. And if you expect to have more than that in the building, you need to get more judges. And that's just the way it is. So, and if you skimp on that, you're going to have a poor event. You're going to lose, you know, things are going to suffer if you don't have enough judge staff. So, paying judges is this mammoth expense. Like, you know, I don't remember the exact specifics, but it was well over $50,000. Like,
Wow. So go. Like, a lot of people don't realize when they hear like that number, like, why is it $100 for a GP? Well, $50,000 just for judges, people. Like,
so,
when you
so
start to see, like,
think about it,
breakdown.
Like, a level three judge, part of it, if you look at it, judges get paid, like, a level three judge is getting paid something like, $60 an hour. Let's see. We paid our judges last year. Our level three judges got paid $1,350 for a 3-day weekend. That's $450 a day. You're working a 10-hour day-ish, 10 to 12-hour day. So you're getting like $45 an hour, $45 an hour, which seems insane. Why are we paying these people this much? Well, they have to travel there. They have to book their own airplane ticket. They have to put themselves up in a hotel for the weekend or Airbnb. They have to feed themselves. Like, it's not like all that money goes in a judge's pocket and they walk away laughing. Like, that's,
and they've also spent 5 years becoming a level three.
Exactly.
So,
there's all this time investment. And to be honest, if you ask most level three judges, how much money or stuff do you walk away from a GP with after covering your own expenses? It's going to be like, yeah, I made like $80 this weekend, or I got to keep my three boxes that I got, and that was just pure gravy. I got to draft with a bunch of my buddies for free. It was great. It was awesome. So it's still it's pretty close to a zero sum game, because there's so many other people that this money's going to. The hotel, the airplane companies,
Sure.
Airplane companies, that's what we call them nowadays, right?
Yeah, wait, airlines. Yeah, no problem. It's okay, Flintstone. We got you.
Yabba-dabba-doo.
So staff is obviously there, and then venues are probably not getting cheaper either, right? And now everyone expects food trucks and expects like this high-end like food service as well now.
Yeah.
So
and all that is sort of, I mean, food trucks, if you're doing it right, you shouldn't have to pay. Food trucks is a bit of a sore point for the Toronto community because our food truck situation was awful last year. We'll definitely have more food trucks this year. We were lied to by the food truck companies because they didn't want us to get four food trucks in there. They were like, oh,
they wanted one.
We want to be the only ones, right? There's two of us. Yeah, we can handle any volume. We do this stuff all the time. No problem. I'm like, our players are hungry. Like, yeah, no, 2,500 people, no problem. We got this. And obviously, they got crushed.
Yes, I waited 25 minutes.
Yep.
I was like, come on.
Yep, to get some slop on a plate. Yeah, it's anyway. So now they understand, and I understand not to believe them. They just want a bigger market share. But anyway, so lessons learned.
So
I'm
then
sorry.
Do you think, like, based on everything you've seen, right? So GPs aren't going to get cheaper. There's just no way, right?
So here's the reality of the situation. We put, we walked away making some profit last year, but that's only if you don't factor in all the time and energy that went into planning it. If you count the
six months of planning,
exactly,
yeah, you lost money.
Then we lost money.
What I'm saying is for the average player who's out there and looks at it and says, you know, what, like, because are we cresting three digits? Like, is by 2018, $100 a GP is that what it is now? And I'm not talking buying the extra VIP water bottle.
You're talking the main event
stuff,
entry.
Which,
yep.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's,
you know, like, because the average player does, like, that's what, that's starting to become the majority of the expense now.
Here's what I want to see, and here's what I think Wizards would be totally happy with. At the end of the GP, and this is something that surprised me, I asked Wizards, what do you guys consider a successful GP? Because I wanted to, you know, as we were planning last year, I was like, I want to make sure that we're doing the things that you want to see. And, you know, I was like, you know, a big GP is obviously good, right? Having the more people who show up, the better. And they were like, no. We do not care about the number of people who attend your Grand Prix. I was like, what? I was like, they were like, yep, we want to see that you make a reasonable guess as to how many people are going to show up. And then we want to see that you take care of those people who do show up. That the people who do show up have a great time. I was like,
Customer experience is number one.
Far and away above above volume. Attendance or volume, yeah. And what I full and then that was the first thing. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And in a sense, from Wizards' experience, this is a promotional event for them. They spend a ton of money on the Grand Prix circuit every year, so it totally makes sense that as a promotional thing, you want people to be happy, not there to be more people who are unhappy, right? Having 1,000 happy customers is way better than having 2,000 unhappy customers. And the other thing that shocked me was that Wizards didn't care. They like to see when they were evaluating how many people came out to enjoy your experience, the number of people in the main event was not the number they looked at. It was the total unique players across all events, main event and side events.
All right. So they understand that the GP is more than the main event now. Because that is something that for a long time I wanted to advocate that. Just because you don't want to sit for, you know, eight rounds a day, you know, in the main event doesn't mean you don't go to
exactly.
The GP. The GP is more like, you know, we've been advocating this since Heavy Meta. Like, the festival atmosphere really is more interesting because it allows more people who have different tastes. Like, some people just want to have frontier side events. Like, who knows, so, right? Whatever your jam is.
There should be that
if the GP
you
is
the
provided.
GP. Yeah. Yes. And The most interesting metrics, and these were some of the numbers that Wizards was super excited about from our last GP, is that our main event, it was standard. We had 1,700 and change, like just over 1,700 players, which is like fine for standard in Toronto, you know, largest constructed GP ever in Canada. So yay, great. But we had 1,300 other people who did not play the main event who also played a side event. And that meant we had a total number of like 3,000 players, unique players, in the building over the course of the weekend. And Wizards was ecstatic about that. And they were ecstatic about the ratio, that we only had 400 more people play the main event as sides. So it means almost half the people in the building were there just to play sides, which is perfect.
And moving forward,
that seems like the way we should be looking at Grand Prix. What, main event's $100? Tell the TO, screw you, I'm not playing the main event. I'm going to show up and just play sides that are great value, and I'm going to have a ton of fun, and blah, blah, blah. And if going to the Pro Tour isn't that important to you, then why are you playing the main
event?
There's
still stuff for you to
do. There's tons of stuff for you to do.
Exactly.
And if that keeps happening and we keep evolving, and Grand Prix Toronto 2018 is this festival weekend where 25% of the people in the building are playing the main event and 75% of the people in the building are just hanging out playing Magic, who cares? So what?
No,
what?
Well, that again, that's serving the, I don't want to say the casual base, but I want to say it's just serving the other parts of the Magic community
exactly.
That really don't get served by the I'm going to say air quotes, promotional tour. Right?
Yeah.
The promotional GP tour is for the professional player or the pseudo professional player just wants to like, I want to make the big show. But now they're realizing viewing like Commander and a lot of the other, you know, formats that are casual based to an extent, that's still fun. It's still part of the game. And the more people that you have inside the Festival of Magic, that's just better. It attracts more people, right? So, and when you go and you can see that there is there's a lot of different ways to enjoy the GP. It's just a win-win for everyone. So I think that's great. Like, I agree with you that if we could see more of a more unique ways to price the GP is what I'm hoping, where, yes, you can play the main event, but maybe you could buy like a 3-day pass kind of thing where, I don't know, it allows you maybe like unlimited side events.
Oh,
I'm not
Maddie,
sure how to do it and what that price would be.
Just wait. We'll do an episode where we talk once we have all the details locked in for GP Toronto 2017, which will be our final. I got some clever.
We're going out with a bang? Are we going out with a bang? That's what we're doing.
So that, I mean, we're getting long here, I know. But that's one thing I want to touch on too is the, let's talk to CFB, tell them what we want to see, and maybe you can straight up, you know, if you email CFB and say, hey, I love coming to Magic tournaments, I can't afford to pay $100 for a main event, please make sure there's accessible side events for me, and I don't really care about going to the Pro Tour, or I'd like to, but whatever, I can't afford to pay $100 for a main event, so make sure there's cool sides, then they'll hear that, and they'll make like the Saturday morning special that's $30 or whatever, you know, and maybe, you know, there's no path to the Pro Tour on it, but there's also, you know, there's still, you get something for shining up and you get some prize tickets for the prize wall and yada, yada, you know? So
I think that it's good for the game to realize that Magic is more than just making the Pro Tour. Like, and I know casuals have always understood that, but there's been this segment of the population that sits between the kitchen table and the PT grinder.
Yeah.
And those are the people that it's hard for, like, all the new formats, like Frontier, even Modern to an extent, and other formats, they're all a result of that group of people, that they want a semi-competitive environment, but they're not trying to make the Pro Tour. They just want maximum fun.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
But at a high relative level of skill.
Totally.
So,
totally.
Like, if we get more of that, that's great.
That's what the FaceToFaceGames.com open series is about and stuff like that, right? Of like, yes, there's no way for you to get to. That's what the Sunday Showdown series is about. There's no Pro Tour invite attached to this, but there's something with a little bit of prestige. There's a trophy. Sure, it's made out of plastic, but it's like nice plastic, you know?
Hey, it's better than the Wizards one. Yeah, right? All right, well, we're like almost crashing in on our end mark, but I know you had some wild theories, so let's end the show with some fun stuff. We're going to talk about theory predictions here of future sets, masterpieces, the ever-increasing value or the I'm going to call it the hype train, because once you're on the hype train of masterpieces, well, how do you make them more hyper for the next time? So I know you've had some interesting theories I've heard circling around, and I couldn't leave this episode without hearing these. Because Because everyone, you know, they rail at me for having wild, crazy theories. And now I'm like, no, no. I have a master where I learned this from.
Okay, so this is like, oh, man. This is like full-on tinfoil hat stuff here. So
I got my tinfoil hat on.
Everyone got your tinfoil hats at home? Yeah.
Yeah.
Put them on.
Put your hats on. Put your hats on.
2018.
Okay.
Eternal Masters 2018 gets announced. But at the same time as they announce it, there's also an update to the ban and to the reserve list. Now the reserve list
already my tinfoil hat's cracking. Yeah, like, right now.
There's lightning bolts flying everywhere. So your dynamo tower is in mode.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So the reserve list is then split into two chunks, and all cards on the reserve list fall into reserve list cards, just like we normally have, and then like reserve-ish list cards, as Tony named it. That's the second category.
And okay.
And the reserve list cards are highlighted in red. Still never print these ever. But reserve-ish list cards are in face-to-face orange, you know? And they are, the rule is that they can still never be printed except in the masterpiece slot in a Masters booster pack.
Okay, so... So
not regular sets. Not even regular sets can have these in the Masterpiece slots, only in a Masters set. And then...
Okay, so for... So hold on. For the regular person that their eye is twitching right now because they can't believe what you just said, you're saying that power, essentially power 9, maybe power 12, whatever, those cards, off the list, never, in a vault, we're not...
Exactly.
But... Dual lands. And I think mostly it's the dual lands that you're talking
about. I'm talking about...
Those have the opinion to be...
I'm talking about dual lands. I'm talking about weird, like, Hazazon Tamar, like, random legends from Legends.
Okay.
I'm talking about, like Tolarian Academy, like, all these weird commander cards, like Phyrexian Tower, all these, like, weird cards
Metal Worker on the reserve list?
Probably, I think that's true, right? Like, all these cards that are pretty expensive.
Ooh, Phyrexian Dreadnought,
yes. Right? Like, all these things that are not breaking any format. Reprinting them wouldn't be that bad. It's not like...
But they're just rare.
They're just rare. Yeah, exactly. They're just rare and they're hard to find.
They're just...
And that's... It's making Legacy decks pretty expensive if you want to play them. It's making Commander decks really expensive if you want to have, like, a Tier 1 Commander deck with, like, Phyrexian Tower and all the, you know, Volrath Stronghold and all these good cards.
So to clarify, you're not saying these will be standard masterpieces. You're saying these are going to be the ninth rarity. They're going to be in master sets, but as masterpieces in master sets.
So you're opening 144 Eternal Masters booster packs to get one of these. All right?
So, that feels hype driven for sure. Like, that's going to generate excitement, but it feels like it's going to barely put any actual cards into the marketplace. Like if you did this, these feel to me like they would be more expensive than the actual original cards.
Exactly.
No, yeah, but that doesn't make it cheaper. That doesn't do
it. No, but it makes it accessible all of a sudden, right?
Does it make it accessible? I don't know.
It puts more in the marketplace. Here's how it makes it accessible. Because Uber Legacy player who's pimped out their entire Legacy deck, except the cards that don't exist in foil, will now exist in foil. And then that person is going to buy these $800 Underground Seas, these $800 Expedition Underground Seas, and then they're going to unload their revised or their foreign black borders or whatever current version they have.
Sure.
And it'll just free up some of them, and then at the same time, it'll be injecting regular Eternal Masters cards into the format, you know, things that are not on the reserve list are also going to get reprinted, and it's going to make Legacy and you know, a little bit of Vintage, but mostly just Legacy and Commander more accessible. So
that is a bold theory.
I think it's a pipe dream.
It's tinfoil, but it's awesome. Like, to even think like that is really cool. Just to think like one day we could have unique stuff. So that does tell you that there's a lot of still really interesting stuff you could do with keeping the hype train going, because Amakat's coming. It's our fourth time, third or fourth time with Masterpieces.
Yeah.
It's going to be like, where do they go, right? So I have the same fear in terms of, well, let's say you put spells or enchantments this time, or maybe they just pick Grixis cards or whatever they're going to do if it relates to pyramids.
Or, yeah,
sure.
Know, yeah.
Like that's fine. And, you know, maybe, in my opinion, they're only doing 10. Like, they're probably going to do a few. They're not doing 30. They're going to just do 10 in each set or something and ratchet it down a bit because you're just running out of room. Like, what's left, right? And then what? Set after that, you've got Planeswalkers. So, yeah, there's still a couple of sets where it's going to be exciting because we see a Masterpiece version of a card for the first time. But by 2018, 2019, I don't know. I feel like, who cares now? That's really where you're going to start to hit the wall. And that's where I believe you're partially correct that Masterpieces in Masterpiece sets does sound like what those sets are going to need in 2 to 3 years to get them exciting.
And people would lose their mind. The whole internet would like explode with rage of like, this is such a cash grab, blah, blah, blah. But who cares? It's extra value. Look, it's replacing a token for poop's sake. Like, come on.
In the way I look at it is like this. When Jace the Mind Sculptor gets unbanned in Modern and you have full art Jace the Mind Sculptors as an expedition, I don't think anyone's going to care. They're going to try to bust that lottery ticket because right. that will be the lottery ticket.
Yep.
Right? Like, yep. That's going to be the thing to do.
And why not? Why not?
And why not, right? But, you know, it is what it is. Like, this is the future of Magic right now, and I don't see them stopping unless... I just don't see them stopping because I don't know how you stop. Like, how do you release a set without Masterpieces? Oh, you know, because then people feel like you're taking something away.
Yeah, of course. You've given it to us. Now we got to find ways to continue it going. You know, I mean, what if maybe someday they come up with Masterpieces, you know, like, oh, well, this version of Crucible of Worlds Masterpiece is like 3D holographic. Like, whoa. Yeah.
You know, Tony had the best idea I ever heard, which was what they need to do is get rid of Masterpieces. And what they should do is just take the mythics of the set, or maybe not even the mythics, just pick 10 cards that are in this set that you know have playability. Like, obviously, Fatal Push. There's a card right there that you clearly can see. You don't need to predict anything. Even if you design the set 5 years from now, you clearly know that card's going to go into Eternal Format. So why not just do a full art textless version of it? And put it in the set. And then do a full art textless foil version. And just don't even say anything. Just, hey, it's out there. You know? So every set, it's a mystery of what cards are the chases that you don't know. And that, I feel, is a very interesting way to do it. Because there's no expectations of set amount. It's just, we did it. And you got to find
it. Well, Kelly knows this from becoming an official Pokemon master recently.
Oh, man.
But they're like, the secret rares in Pokemon are like super kick-ass, right?
Yeah, they're totally awesome.
And it's only really the playables. And not only is it the playables, but they have full art foils. And then they have, like, full art rainbow rares. And
Pokemon made a new rarity, this set. Like, that's rainbow rare. It's like rainbow secret rare. Like, whoa, it's super cool.
And it's the full art foil art with a different, like...
Full art, fart, foil.
Like, because, the original version... Pokemon's going crazy. The original version in the set doesn't have, like, the full art. And then the full art is different looking, and then there's the rainbow version of the full art.
Yeah. It's crazy.
That's amazing.
I mean, I hope Magic doesn't go that crazy unless... Actually, okay, I hope there is some fun in the future where we go to a set where it's not about war and killing and all this stuff. And it's just a fun, like, if everyone knows DC Comics, you know Mixelplix, the crazy guy? Like, imagine we go to a world. Yeah, I want to go to a plane with a guy like that where everything is just nuts. Like, it's fun. So maybe there is, like, some silly triple rainbow version of Jace because Mixelplix made him, like, his cape farts rainbows or something. Just
Deadpool something crazy. A unicorn.
Yeah.
Really.
next Rainbow Hat Theory. Okay, last Rainbow Hat Theory. Unset 3, third unset of Magic. Okay. Rosewater's totally on board with this. It's a regular unset with all kinds of wacky rules and silly ridiculousness. But in the Mythic Rare slot, there is like cartoon versions of all your favorite cards printed with regular backs and borders. Like,
what?
Like that Jace, like cartoon Jace, like bonking.
Anna Jace. You know, yeah, anima Jace.
Yeah. Or no, not anime. Like full on Animaniacs style, like with a big rubber mallet.
Imagine if they had a bunch of guest artists to do so you could get like a Derf Jace.
Right?
What? That would be nuts.
And it's all a bunch of planeswalkers. It's like 25 planeswalkers, all with like totally goofball art, like totally hilarious, just pure jokes. But they're in the set, so you could wind up drafting them in undraft.
I mean, they actually did that with Pokemon, right? Like, there's art that is like drawn by.
Really?
Yes, there are. Yeah, some of the secret rares in the new Pokemon set is like looks like art drawn by kids.
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
Really.
It's,
okay.
Wow.
Okay. Well, you know what? Hey, guys. I know a guy. Kevin Metal. He does rare instances where he will do commissioned artwork. So maybe we could get him back to do a whole stick figure drawings of planeswalkers, and we'll throw
them
in.
Is the commission a bottle of Kraken?
Yeah. Pretty much. Oh man. All right, guys. Well, that is. Whew, that is one way to go out, let me tell you. Just out on multiple rainbows and kid drawing. This is the future of magic, people.
Yep.
You gotta love it.
You teach me and I'll teach you. Pokemon!
Gotta catch them all.
Yeah.
Every challenge along the way, with courage I will face. I will battle every day to claim my rightful place. Come with me, the time is right. There's no better team. Arm in arm, we'll win the fight. It's always been our dream. It's you and me. I know it's my destiny.
By saying, like, tell your TOs, tell, you know, let's keep everybody excited about Magic going forward. Let's make sure that every TO who's running an event for the last time in the next 8 months makes it an amazing event.
Show them your love.
Right? Because there's still regional events that these TOs are going to get asked to run by Wizards. Like, it's not like they're going to throw in the towel and just rake everybody over the coals. Let's continue to make this awesome and fun for everyone. And let's have Magic continue to be fantastic.
You got it, buddy.
Awesome.
Well, thanks for coming on,
totally.
Man. You're our first
thanks
guest, so
me.
You go down in the hype history as the first guest. I don't know how we top you. I don't know how we masterpiece the next version, the next guest.
There will be many more an awesome guests, I'm sure. So,
all right, now Kelly can slide on out of here.
Yep.
Yeah, slide on
covered
out,
covered in soap.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll just throw sprinkles on you as you leave.